Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis, and today we're going to talk about the Pandora's box that President Biden, I think, has opened with the changes to the income-driven repayment plans that he has done. And today, I just want to talk about what this means for borrowers, right? Because who cares if it's a Pandora's box, right? The reason, so Pandora's box is like this Greek mythology thing that it's just kind of like common parlance for like doing something that's going to create a whole lot of problems down the road. And I definitely think that this qualifies. The reason I'm saying that is because you have to think not about the fact that Biden is in office right now, but who will be in office in the future. And if you are a student loan borrower, you know, you probably want stability. These new IDR regulations, while intended to create simplicity, are going to create a lot of instability in the system overall. If you think about the new regulations, what's going on? There's a couple key things. There is plan blocking. So it's stopping borrowers from signing up for new plans beyond a certain date. There are plan revisions of existing plans in there. And so that's going to create some issues, in particular if there's revisions that are made that are to create plans that are less generous in the future. There's limitations on switching plans. There are encouragements of people to file taxes separately. Schools are going to be able to do whatever they want. Parent Plus borrowers with these new regulations are going to get themselves into a bunch of government-sanctioned trouble. And fewer people will pay down loans. And the good news, though, is borrowers will save a lot of money, at least for probably about 3 years at a minimum. And not all borrowers, but some borrowers will save a lot of money with these regulations. And so I want to talk about each one of those different kind of points and just explain why they would be concerning to a group like ours who are trying to help borrowers save as much money as possible long term. So let's talk about the plan blocking that's going on in these new regulations. It makes sense that there's too many plans. Everybody knows that. Everybody agrees on that. The question is what should the plan be? And on that point, no one agrees. So Biden obviously wants this SAVE plan to be the plan. Congressional House Republicans want a plan that would keep you in debt until you paid back principal plus 10 years of interest. So that would essentially mean that our higher debt-to-income ratio clients, real high debt-to-income ratio professions, would essentially pay for their entire lives. So there would be no more time-limited forgiveness. So you'd have like 70-year IBR. And that's just what has been proposed on the House side. I think they'd probably put in some sort of like maximum amount of time you can be in debt if they actually were thinking that this plan might actually get voted on, but they're not doing that at the moment. Senate Republicans essentially just want the one plan to rule them all to just be the repay plan, the old repay plan. So they just want to replace everything with that one plan, which is sort of a little bit more moderate approach than really either one, the SAVE plan or the more intense version for the House Republicans, what they're putting forward, right? What Biden is doing with these new regulations is he's phasing out anyone signing up for pay and ICR after July 2024. Now, the exception is Parent Plus borrowers can still access the ICR plan. So nobody is going to be able to sign up for these plans after July 2024 unless you're already on them. If you're on them, you can stay on them if you like. Now, why is that kind of a little bit troubling? So think about where all these plans come from. So if you're anything besides income-based repayment, IBR, everything else comes from this ICR statute. So this ICR statute is this huge loophole that really only Democratic administrations so far have used to create more plans to help borrowers. And this ICR loophole exists because Congress in the 90s wrote a bill that basically said that this ICR plans shall be no more than 25 years until forgiveness and no more than 20% of income. Of course, the no more than made, you know, Democratic administrations realize that that means they could write plans that are less than. And then what has happened since is these administrations have been testing the limits of how generous that can mean. The ICR plans have gotten more and more generous. Now, the thing is all these plans are listed in promissory notes, right? So pay, ICR, repay, all these things are listed in promissory notes. So this is the first time we've ever seen an administration try to stop people from signing up for a plan that would historically at least have been listed in promissory notes. Now, for people who are new borrowers, that makes sense to me. You could just take the pay plan out of their promissory note. But if you are on, say, repay and you have pay in your promissory note and you want to sign up for it in 2025, the administration's not going to let you. And that means that's kind of pretty shocking, really, because it's in your promissory note. You're promised a plan in your promissory note, but now you're being stopped from signing up for it. So that's concerning because that's taking away the sort of precedent that if something's in your promissory note, you get to keep it no matter what. So this, again, all these ICR plans are separate from this IBR authority. The income-based repayment plan is literally defined in the law exactly what it is. It says if you're borrowed before 2014, then you're eligible to pay 15% of your income for 25 years. If you're a new borrower as of 2014, then you're able to pay 10% of your income for 20 years. So the reason why we never talk about new IBR is because new IBR is the exact same thing as pay as you earn, basically. Since everyone up to this point has been eligible for both, we don't like the confusion of old IBR and new IBR. People get kind of confused about those plans. And so we tell everyone to do pay as you earn if they needed to go for 20 years and 10% of income, because that is just a plan that makes more sense. It's more straightforward. But this new IBR plan is going to become a lot more important in a bit, and we'll talk about why. President Biden is saying that they now have the power to stop new people from signing up for a plan after a certain date. So think about this with a Republican president. And again, I'm approaching this solely from the vantage point of a borrower with lots of debt, thinking about concerns that borrower would have, especially if that borrower is already on an income-driven plan or thinking about signing up for one. So let's say this hypothetical Republican president has the power to block new entrants to any plan derived by the ICR statute after a certain date. You could effectively limit everyone from signing up for anything besides ICR, which is 20% of income and with a very low poverty line deduction, right? So you could basically say, hey, guess what? Because Biden did this, I'm going to do this too and block anyone from signing up for a plan that's not extremely expensive. Now, more likely, what would happen is they would block all plans but the old repay plan, since that's what Republican senators wanted. Presumably, that would be their quote-unquote moderate choice, would be to just say you could sign up for that old repay plan that everybody knows about, but none of these other plans. So this SAVE plan, I have great concerns about how permanent it really is, because think about this kind of like, I'll just give you another example. Biden lost on cancellation in front of the Supreme Court. The decision was emphatic that he could not do cancellation of any kind, right? What does he do? Right afterwards, he announces that he's going to try to cancel debt again by the Higher Education Act, which they know is going to fail, but they're doing it anyway because politics, right? Now, the same kind of thing happened with the eviction moratorium, right? They lost in front of the Supreme Court about the eviction moratorium, and then Biden said he didn't think he could do it, and then he got pressure and then from his party, and then he decided to do it anyway, and then the court overturned him a month or so later. So essentially, the reason why I think that you can kind of look at this past behavior to predict future behavior is kind of think about what happened with the child tax credits. The child tax credits, that whole thing was a big bet by the Democratic Party that they would do these very expanded, expensive child tax credits and very generous and helpful child tax credits too to people with children, right? Families with children. And the bet was that this would be so politically popular that no one would be able to repeal it. The Republicans would never, ever be able to repeal these tax credits. So I think they made them, you know, temporary or something like that, and essentially gambled that they would be able to extend them because Republicans wouldn't dare block them because they'd be so popular. And then what happened? The child tax credits were not that popular a couple years afterwards. People, rightly or wrongly, blamed them for inflation, the economic like angst and instability, and then they didn't survive, and those expanded child tax credits got killed. I'm not saying that same thing's going to happen with the SAVE plan, but it's something that's kind of concerning. Biden, in a comment, or his press secretary or someone in his press office said something like, you know, oh, we can't possibly imagine a legal challenge to this SAVE plan. This is something that we feel is a very strong authority for President Biden to do. To me, that almost kind of makes me think that they're expecting a legal challenge, the way they said that. And I'm not necessarily saying that legal challenge would be successful, but this is very transformational what they're doing. Like the most expensive, this is probably one of the most expensive executive actions in American history, this new IDR plan. I guess I'm a little concerned that when you do something this big that gets this much attention, that the CBO scores is much more expensive than what the president said it was, that this is something that at a minimum, if maybe it survives until the next Republican president, at a minimum, right? So let's say if you're really counting on the SAVE plan, right? Your worst case scenario would be Biden loses 2024, Republican president start sworn in January 2025. They have to do negotiated rulemaking, which means they would have to get the group together and come out with a bill or with the new regulations literally that exact same year. to get them out by that following July. That would be too fast, right? So presumably they wouldn't be able to get the negotiated rulemaking group together until, you know, sometime in probably late 2024, early 2025. And that means that any regulations they came up with would first be effective in July 2026. So that's why we can sort of say at a minimum, you've got until July 2026 before they'd be able to scale this back if there's no sort of serious legal challenge that blocks the save plan. But say you do have a Republican president at that point, that Republican president could try to block the save plan. Now, we'll talk in a little bit in a second why they might even be able to change for people that are already on it. But I want to sort of talk about the other scenario, which would be, let's say Biden does win in 2024. Well, then you know that the save plan is probably safe until at least July 2030, because it's not going away anytime until then. And so you might say, well, it's been around a long time. You know, they wouldn't scale it back at that point, right? Think about the Trump tax cuts. I think it's quite likely that unless Republicans control the House and the Senate and the presidency in 2025, then the Trump tax cuts are going to get repealed. That's something that's been around for, you know, 6 or 7 years. Now, is that going to be as politically unpopular as those tax cuts, like the IDR plan? You know, probably not. Will it get as much attention as those tax cuts? Probably not. But it's still something that among Republicans, it might get that much attention. And so that's why I'm saying, you know, I think that if you have a Republican president either this next term or the term after that, the save plan might get scaled back a lot, or at least very limited for people who can sign up, based off of the precedent of saying that you can block plans like pay-as-you-earn from people signing up. I definitely don't want you to feel like this is a negative show today. I just want to like make sure that you're fully informed about what really I think being on the save plan really means, right? Being on the save plan means you're going to save a lot of money in many cases, but that you can't necessarily plan for that for absolute ever. Other plans like the new IBR plan, which is statutory, or even the pay plan, which they're letting current people stay on, I think those plans are a little bit safer. I mean, pay has been around since 2013. It's a 10-year-old plan. New IBR and old IBR, those are defined in the law, so you'd have to have 60 senators in, you know, that would want to overturn those to change them. Whereas the save plan, you know, so you probably, a lot of cases, still want to do it. But it's just, there's a lot more to know, I think, than there has been historically back when the IDR plans were more like Obama comes out with a generous one and people mostly don't really care. And then Obama's like, oh, maybe that one was a little bit too generous, pay as you earn. So I'm going to do revised pay as you earn and I'm going to make it basically worse in every way except for the interest subsidy. And the interest subsidy we're going to offer is a modest one. So that's, I think, why people really didn't pay attention that much to student loans, that, like, in a big way, until it became this big campaign issue in 2020 with the pause and with cancellation and those kind of things. Now people are paying attention, which means that it's just, there's going to be more policy volatility, right? I do think, though, that say you did have a Trump win in 2024, you know, I actually think maybe he would just ignore the save plan. He certainly ignored everything about student loans in his first term. You were just going to try to extrapolate. I would think that it might be possible that he would just ignore everything about student loans in the second term if he were to win. You know, I think it's probably safe to say if it's Trump or Biden, save is probably safe until 2030. But if it's somebody else, like DeSantis, or pick any of the other Republicans right in the field, if it's somebody else, it's more of like a little bit more, I don't want to say traditional conservative, because I don't necessarily think that those, that you would use that word, but, you know, if just somebody that's more conservative, they, I think, would look at that save plan. So let's talk about plan revisions. Old repay is no more. And why is that? President Biden is using executive action to amend the terms of the old repay plan, even though they're in people's promissory notes. So by that logic, let's say you have a Republican president who appoints a conservative, you know, Betsy DeVos-style Secretary of Education. And let's say that Secretary of Education studies the save plan and says that under, you know, her understanding, the plan is supposed to yield repayment of loans, and this current save plan does not do that. And so, but to align with congressional intent, they need to amend the current terms of the save plan back to what they were for current borrowers. Could they do that, and would they do that? Yes, I think they very well could, because we now have a lot more educational polarization than we have had before. So that educational polarization, right? You know, more educated voters disproportionately vote for Democrats, less educated voters disproportionately vote for Republicans these days. So it didn't used to be like that in terms of partisanship being defined by education level. Now envision having those new repay save rules go back to the old repay rules, but now you also cannot sign up for the pay plan. That would be very concerning, because then your only option if you need to file taxes separately would be old IBR, and that would be way more expensive for people. That's a reason why if you borrowed any time between 2007 and 2014 for your first loan, right, that was the first time you ever borrowed, then I would be very cautious if you're on the pay plan to leave it, because I think that you just want to think long and hard about doing that, because the benefits of the save plan compared to pay, you know, the payment in some cases is about, on average, is about $100 a month cheaper on the save plan. So yes, that's real money, but you do have the 5-year difference on the forgiveness date, and you do have the cap on payments, right? And yeah, you don't have the interest subsidy, but let's be real, the tax bomb's not happening anyway. So the interest subsidy, if you're going for forgiveness, is really not that relevant. These plan revisions that are now allowed, that means a future president could look at the current versions of the income-based plans, and any plan that's not defined in the law, like IBR is, so all the other ones, a president could change, because Biden changed them, and there's legal precedent now for him doing that. There's also a plan switching limitation. So we have the first limit ever on signing up for a statutory repayment plan. So old and a new IBR are literally in the law. It's defined who can access them based off of when you first borrowed loans. If you borrowed loans before 2014, you have old IBR, which is 15% of your income and 25 years till forgiveness. New IBR is 10% of income and 20 years till forgiveness. So this is defined in the law as to who can sign up for them. But Department of Ed, wanting to make a plan that they wanted everybody to sign up for and not game the system, they did not want to allow people to do the repay or save plan for 19 years and then switch at the last second to new IBR and get their loans forgiven. So they did not want to allow that happen. So they decided they wanted to impose limitations on people signing up for that new IBR plan if they'd been on the repay save plan for a while. Now, originally they were thinking, let's make it a 10-year period where you can switch plans, but then they got concerned, you know, about just that's too long. And so then they said 5 years. So it's 5 years starting July 2024. So the first time someone would be blocked from signing up for income-based would be in July of 2029 right now. So that's what the regulations say. That means if you're a new grad with loans from only 2014 and after, you could do the save plan and then switch before that date to the new IBR plan if your income is rapidly increasing and you think you want to get forgiveness after 20 years, that you might want to switch from save to IBR. But here's the real problem. We know that when borrowers have a lot going on with their lives, and especially when something gets put on autopilot, people forget. People don't remember. So the vast majority of people that need to switch plans are not going to remember to do that. And that could mean tens of thousands of dollars in extra payments per year for those last 5 years of payments. So that's a big deal. Biden's imposing this switching limit, you know, and it's arbitrary. 5 years, 10 years, like just pick a number, right? So why could a new president not say, well, you can't switch at all? Let's say you've been on this, you know, repay save plan. Imagine a worst case scenario where they amend the current terms of that plan to being old repay, and they say you're not allowed to switch plans to the income-based plan where you might need to file your taxes married filing separately. That's a scenario now, because for the first time, we're talking about blocking people from switching plans that are guaranteed to them in the statute. It's serving the higher purpose of these regulations making sense and trying to get people push them towards one plan without making that one plan ultra generous for the highest debt, highest income borrowers, which I very much know was one of the things that the Department of Ed considered in this. If you read their 427 pages of income-based repayment regulations, essentially they were concerned that they created all these plans that were too generous for grad borrowers compared to undergrad borrowers. They didn't think they're too generous for grad borrowers overall. They were just concerned that they did not get the undergrad borrowers incentivized to use income-based and get them forgiveness as much as grad borrowers. And so their approach was, well, let's make this plan a little bit more generous for grad borrowers. And it's really a lot of it if you look at the interest subsidies. But the interest subsidies and the family size deduction, we'll apply that to everybody. But we're going to do this 5% of income thing for undergrad borrowers to try to supercharge their ability to get forgiveness. Let's talk about the changes in incentivizing they've done to create more people doing married filing separate. This is going to be something that is a massive, I would say, middle class and upper middle class sort of tax loophole that's going to happen. So millions of people, I think it's like 3 or 4 million file separately for taxes right now. And most of the increase in that status is due to student loans and people needing to do that for student loans. Now, with this new regulation with 225% of the poverty line, anyone with children now, especially 2 or more children, is going to be heavily subsidized, incentivized incentivized and subsidized, I suppose, to file taxes separately. Because most people don't make $200,000-$400,000 a year. Most people make maybe mid to high five figures. And anyone in that boat with two kids filing separately that's married is essentially going to be claiming a family size of three instead of four because you have to exclude the spouse. But these new 225% of the poverty line regulations mean that, you know, you'll be deducting about $55,000 of income before paying anything. So if you think about most people make in that 55 to 100K or, you know, 50 to 100K range, it's like a typical post-college salary for your average college borrower, right? Then, you know, think about how if you had to include your spouse's income in that mix because your spouse doesn't have student loans, which is still a lot of people, right? So if you just layered on, you know, an extra 50 to 100K of income, then now your payments, you know, you're not getting any interest subsidies, you're having to make the payment, the payment's kind of high, so you're not going to get forgiveness. So you're going to see literally millions of people file taxes separately that you didn't see before. And that's going to be confusing because it's just people, it's just layering on complexity for taxes, right? Everybody wants a system where you can just, you know, you've seen this on John Oliver, right? Like, hey, the government already knows what you made because you've already, you know, worked and paid your wages and you've already had withholding. So you don't even, you shouldn't even need to file your taxes, right? Except guess what? This is just yet another complexity in the tax code that people that have resources and hire expert help are going to get benefited, are going to get benefits from. And people who don't are just going to pay more in their loans than they need to. And, you know, that's not a good system, but it's the system that we have. Now, schools, let's talk about the impact of this on schools. So schools are really getting the message to just buckle up and go big. I mean, just go for it. Just rocket ship. Let's go to the moon on our tuition prices, right? Now, the Biden administration, out of fairness, did say that they're trying to create some accountability measures to try to publish lists of schools that are raising their prices too fast. Guess what? The schools don't care. Unless you have teeth behind regulations saying that schools cannot raise their prices, or schools that want to participate in the federal loan program, you know, have to maybe submit requests for raising their prices or something along those lines. Unless you had real teeth to that, you can say that you're going to put schools on a shame list if they raise their prices too fast. But basically, schools are probably just going to say, well, I'm going to make sure that we don't raise our prices going into an election year because we don't want to get in trouble for anything that's just politically tone deaf, right? Like raising your prices 10, 20% in the middle of an election year right after President Biden released this new IDR plan. So what I would think instead is schools are going to be kind of cautious. They're going to probably just test the waters a little bit, you know, your usual 3 to 5% increase. And then schools, I think, are going to, let's just go for it, right? After the election, I think they'll say, all right, time to make some money while the sun is shining, right? So I think that, you know, you'll see vast raises in the tuition prices, very quick raises in the tuition prices, because Federal Reserve in New York has a study that says every $1,000 increase of subsidized student loans raises tuition about $600. So 60 cents on the dollar is the effect of raising subsidized loan limits. But if you're a grad school, especially a bad one that produces grads with low earnings and really high debt, then you've essentially given that grad school unlimited subsidized loans. So what happens when you take a bunch of grad schools and give them unlimited subsidized loans because of the SAVE plan, remember, because it subsidizes all of someone's unpaid interest, and most people graduating from high DTI programs will have $0 a month payments and almost zero interest, if not zero interest. And so that's essentially just really raising the limit on subsidized loans, and people are going to be able to borrow a whole lot of money. And it's going to mostly be subsidized, and it won't be subsidized in school, but after school it will be. And so I think that you're going to see your really kind of aware and sort of shrewd schools like NYU and USC have been raising prices aggressively for a long time because of income-based repayment and understanding the effect that that has on someone's ability to pay a massive amount of debt. But other schools now are too they're going to realize this. They're going to look at the SAVE plan. And since Biden is telling people this is the one plan that everybody should sign up for, people will be more familiar with this plan, I think, than other previous plans, because they're going to brand it as the one plan everybody should sign up for. And so I think financial aid officers will probably look at that plan and recommend it to most people. Those officers will have talks with administration. Administration will be trying to figure out where they set their prices. And administration is going to go the path of least resistance, which is to say, well, we can just do a 10% increase in tuition to cover the inflation adjustment to faculty salaries and the huge increase in healthcare costs in the capital campaign we want to try to help subsidize. So we're just going to raise the prices because we can. So I think that we're going to see a lot of that, unfortunately, in the coming years. Parent PLUS borrowers are going to get themselves into a ton of trouble. And what I mean by that is the Biden administration is stopping the double consolidation loophole after July 2025. So think about what is the alternative if you can't do this. You have to pay 20% of your income over 100% of the poverty line. So what people don't realize too, they're changing the deduction when you file taxes separately. They're going to count only 2 minus 1, basically. If you're a married couple, they're going to only let you count your own self for the poverty line deduction. So that's a poverty line of about $15,000 for a family size with just one person. So you have to pay 20% of everything you earn above $15,000 if you're a parent plus borrower. So let's say you're a parent borrower, you make $30,000 a year. The ICR plan now is going to be asking you to pay $250 a month, give or take, about $3,000 a year, because 20% of that amount over $15,000. So there's about $15,000 over that amount times 20%. That's where you get the $3,000 a year from. Now, somebody who makes $50,000 a year, they'd have to pay about $600 a month on ICR. So a lot of times people find our site in the article on the double consolidation because they're desperate. They have all this debt. Their payment is super high on the ICR plan, and they need a relief valve. And default is not a relief valve because they'll garnish your Social Security and wreck your credit. You know, this double consolidation has been an important loophole for desperate people to find relief, but that's getting shut down for anybody who's not already done it after July 2025. You're safe doing the double consolidation loophole until that date. But after that date, it's shut down. You cannot do it anymore. And so there's a lot of people that currently have kids in school, and maybe multiple kids in school, who were counting on this loophole existing that now no longer can count on it continuing to exist. The good news is you can still do the double consolidation if you have a couple kids that, you know, are in school. You could basically do it, I think, 60 to 90 days after the disbursement date. You can start that double consolidation even if you need to keep borrowing. And so that's good. But the downside is, you know, again, this is going to cause a lot of pain. And remember, parent plus borrowers disproportionately, you know, minority, disproportionately lower income compared to obviously borrowers that can afford to save in a 529 or something like that. So this is going to hurt parents a lot. And that's something that was, I kind of feel like this is an own goal here a little bit. They didn't have to do this. The statute's pretty clear that you're allowed to double consolidate, but they're shutting this loophole down. And sort of like almost daring Congress to do something about it. They literally said in the regulations, they're sort of like, well, somebody's going to have to reform the Parent Plus system with just no suggestions as to what that should be, and just that they're shutting down an important thing that helps Parent Plus borrowers currently. So not real clear as to why they decided to do that, but they are. A couple other points here, and then we'll close out. Loans are going to grow a lot, I think, because fewer people are going to pay down their loans. So this is going to be for a lot of, especially like lower middle class type borrowers, this is going to be like a continuation of the student loan pause. And during the student loan pause, very few people actually paid on their loans. My guess is maybe like 30 to 50% of borrowers, I think, could get zero interest in this new save plan, and because their payments are going to be zero because the poverty line deduction is so high. And so that means fewer borrowers are going to pay down their loans, and schools are going to raise their prices more rapidly because of the effect from having more basically subsidized loan access. That's what the research suggests. And let me say one good thing that will happen. A lot of borrowers are going to save a lot of money with these rules. Like we said, they'll at least be around because of the way regulations work until July of 2026 at a minimum. If you have Trump win instead of Biden, probably around past that date, probably if Biden wins till July 2030, if Trump wins, probably also July 2030. So it's probably only if one of the other Republicans win that you might have to worry about a July 2026 type of date. But there are big concerns here, right? Just because of all the things the Biden administration is doing, they're claiming vast power over the student loan program to rewrite the rules in the way that they think makes the most sense. And the question is, will they be challenged about it? And will that challenge not happen with Biden, but will it happen with the future Republican president? With a borrower who gets much worse terms, maybe that group of borrowers sues that future administration to try to block the changes. And then that case would just go up to whatever version of the Supreme Court we have at that point. So I think that that's maybe where we're heading, if not a challenge over these new IDR rules now. If we don't get that now, then I think we might see it later, but it would be against a conservative reinterpretation of these rules instead of a more progressive interpretation of these rules. So what does this mean for you right now? Like, let me just kind of boil all this down for you. What does it mean at this moment, right? If you're on pay, you absolutely need to get an analysis as to whether or not you should be leaving that plan or not. I think that would be a big mistake to not think through this very carefully, because if how big of a deal getting forgiveness after 20 years instead of 25 is. If you have kind of a modest amount of debt relative to your income and you're a PSLF borrower, I think you've got to get an analysis to make sure that you should not be signed up for a plan that caps your payment. Because remember that if you don't have a partial financial hardship, you cannot switch later into IBR or pay, even if they still exist. You just can't do it. And a lot of PSLF borrowers, especially those with like more modest balances, so for example, a physician who makes $200,000 with $120,000 of student loans, a lot of those physicians assume they cannot get PSLF, but that's a mistake. You have to get on a plan that has a cap on the standard tenure plan, and then that plan just essentially caps you out when you hit your max payment when you're an attending, and then you're able to get a whole lot forgiven on your loans. So PSLF borrowers with, like, let's just say modest amounts of loans relative to their income definitely need an analysis. If you're a PSLF borrower with, actually I'll say if you're any borrower with payments that you last certified a long time ago, you also want to double check to make sure you shouldn't switch, right? Because you might not have to recertify your income until mid-2024 or later, maybe even early 2025. And so if you decide to switch off of a plan to get on this quote-unquote better plan, well, it might be a better plan long-term, but it might be a worse plan short-term because your payment might get recalculated and it might be a lot more, even though it's lower than what it would be if you were asked to recertify under the plan you were on. You're not being asked to recertify, right? So for example, if you're a physician with a $200 a month payment from residency and you've been an attending for 2 or 3 years, maybe you should not be switching to this new save plan because they'll recalculate your payment potentially and cost you thousands of dollars a month. Parent Plus borrowers definitely need help big time to do that double consolidation on steroids, like as fast as possible, just to verify that people are on the right save or pay plan for that Parent Plus loan. And people that have been in repayment for a really long time, people that have been in a repayment that have got loans from a long time ago, the IDR waiver is still going on, folks, till the end of December of this year. And that's going to transform a lot of people's finances as well with big forgiveness that we're going to see going out through that. Who else? Also, people that work for Kaiser Permanente, they just changed the regulations for any kinds of for-profit groups in California where you work at a hospital, but you're technically employed by a for-profit group. California and Texas, they just changed the rules literally a couple weeks ago where you've sent in PSLF certification forms and now they'll count those because they changed the rules as to what a qualifying employer is for PSLF, and they're including Kaiser Permanente hospitals in that definition when they used to exclude them, especially for physicians. Who doesn't need help as much? If you're a recent grad, you might want to consider whether or not you should consolidate your loans or not, because the new regulations on interest capitalization say that probably consolidation does capitalize your interest, but just entering repayment for the first time, I don't think we'll do that anymore. And so you might want to ask yourself, well, does it make sense to start that interest subsidy faster? And basically, it usually takes about 2 months to consolidate after graduation. And then you've got that subsidy that starts right away. Or does it make sense to avoid capitalizing your interest by just waiting that 6-month grace period and then letting the save plan kick in at that point? So there's really a lot of planning that can happen with these new plans. I mean, it's an insane amount of rules, really. And people that get expert help will be able to save a lot of money, and people that don't will save some money. Certainly, if you just do absolutely nothing but sign up for the new save plan, that's going to help. It's certainly going to be, a lot of people will benefit in a big way from that. But obviously, you could go much bigger, right? You could save for your retirement to get bigger interest subsidies by reducing your income. You could, married filing separate community property loopholes are still there. Filing separately loopholes are still there. So there's just also ways of when do you certify your income in the year to get the max subsidy if you're planning to eventually refinance your loans. There's just a whole lot of stuff right now, to be honest, right? A whole lot of ways to save a lot of money. So a couple things. First, if you want to ask a question on the podcast, we'd love to get some of your questions because I'm sure you've got some. So studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. If you want to record something quick on your phone, just go to that, type that into your browser, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and hit the record button and leave like a 30-second message about what you're thinking about. Love to tackle some of those questions on the podcast. And then the second thing is get a plan as soon as you can if you need one. So studentloanplanner.com/book. And historically, when we had the PSLF waiver expiring, we started getting like a month and a half wait list around the beginning of the month that the PSLF waiver was expiring. That would probably mean that the IDR waiver expiring means that we probably will be booked out for the rest of the year, probably starting sometime in like around Thanksgiving or December or like early December. And then with repayments are starting again. The first bill is going to be due October 1st. So if you think about repayments starting again with the IDR waiver expiring, all that stuff is going to happen all at once. And then we'll not be able to help as many people probably as we would want to, because we also want to have team stability and not have to, you know, lay a bunch of people off in January or something. We want to kind of keep the core of what we actually think we need to serve the demand long term, right? So that would be kind of a reason, now that we have these new IDR regulations, and they actually mostly go into effect, everything but the 5% of your income for undergrads goes into effect July 30th of 2023. So literally in a, you know, a few days, it goes into effect. If you have everything you need, I think you should. I would definitely get a plan if you need one at studentloanplanner.com/book. I'm Travis with Student Loan Planner, and thank you for listening to today's show.